Hi, I'm Eric Nee, Managing Editor of Stanford Social Innovation Review, which aims to inform and inspire leaders of social change. Learn more at ssir.org. What have we learned about fighting poverty globally? That's the theme of this panel that I moderated at our recent Frontiers of Social Innovation Forum. The panelists are Yale economist Dean Karlan, Asif Sala of Brock, and Kevin Starr of the Milago Foundation.
This morning, we're going to dig down on the question, what have we learned about fighting poverty globally? What are the types of approaches, programs, organizations, techniques that have proven to work best? And we're lucky to have with us three people, Asif, Dean, and Kevin, who have a great deal of experience and knowledge in this area. One of the reasons that we picked these three in particular is because they each come at this question from different perspectives. Asif is a senior executive at BRAC and brings the perspective of a practitioner and also as somebody who's been long active in the business world. Dean Karlan, professor of economics at Yale, brings the perspective of an academic and researcher. And Kevin Starr, who's also a medical doctor on the side, brings a perspective of a funder. Now, obviously, I don't mean to put them too deeply into these buckets, but we did want that kind of breadth of knowledge and perspective and experience on the panel. The way we're gonna structure this is we have about an hour and a half for this session, which gives us really plenty of time to dig in. And because we have these three terrific people, I wanted to start out by having them each give a sort of a TED-like talk for 15 or so minutes, really presenting in summary form the lessons they've learned. Like, what are the real critical things that they've learned through their experience that you could all benefit from? So we're going to start off by having each of them do that. Then we're going to turn to a moderated discussion, and I'll open it up with a few questions, but I really want to turn it over to you, the audience, as quickly as we can, because I know that you all, after you listen to the three of them, have a lot of questions for them. So please get your questions ready. Mm-hmm. So we're going to start off first with Asif, and then followed by Dean, and then Kevin. So Asif.
Thank you, Eric. So I will start with a little bit of an intro on BRAC, because I realize that a lot of you may not be familiar with it. BRAC has often been compared as the nonprofit world's GE for its sort of complex structure. We have been operating for about 44 years, started in Bangladesh, and currently run about 9 very large-scale programs. We have about 15 social enterprises, 7 social investments, starting from a SME bank to university and insurance, one of the second largest mobile financial services. So our annual budget is over $1 billion, with 70% of that coming from its own resources. 125 million people currently get some sort of services from BRAC. And just to sort of give you some level of idea about the scale as well, we in Bangladesh, we run one of the largest nonprofit secular school system with over 30,000 schools. Our healthcare network has about 100,000 frontline healthcare workers. Our sort of microfinance network has more than 6 million borrowers and savers in their network. So We have some learning based on this experience about what in terms of fighting global poverty. But before I get to that, maybe I can talk a little bit about some of the inconvenient truths in the development sector. I mean, one thing I should mention that oftentimes the whole sector suffers a bit from oversimplification. Elevate the poverty, send poverty to museum. oftentimes, these are very simplified and generalistic. Poor is not a homogeneous group. They don't think alike. There are stratification even in that segment. Their decision making is the same way that happens for others as well. So the solution to attack poverty is going to be more complex. Secondly, oftentimes, where do these poor people live? We often bulk them into the poor countries. And I think post the Second World War, when this whole aid structure was being set up, for lack of better alternatives, so that national average income was measured as an indicator and poor was lumped with the poor countries. But as it happens over the last 50, 60 years, a lot of these poor countries have become middle income or in the lower tier of middle income countries. So as the latest stats show, that 70% of the world poor actually live in these middle income countries. They don't live in these poor countries anymore. So, but the aid structure actually don't support these middle income countries. So we risk a bulk of these people who are at the cusp of graduating out of poverty are not getting some of these helps. Thirdly, coming from this whole looking for these oversimplified solutions, we constantly look for various simplified solution that's going to save us, that's going to basically cure the world of poverty. And in the 90s, it was microfinance. Oftentimes you have one after another, these new fads that come along, and then everybody kind of rallies around and says, yes, this is it. This is going to change the world. But it's not that simple, which basically brings me to the first learning, which is there is no silver bullet. Poverty is a very, very complex phenomena, and there are many, many reasons why poverty actually happens. And whether it's lack of basic services, whether it's lack of access to market, lack of equality, lack of opportunity, lack of hope and confidence or mobilization of the poor people. There are many reasons, many social different social dimensions that basically as the underlying cause of poverty. So unless we attack these underlying causes, poverty is not going to be attacked truly. So there is no one solution, whether it's microfinance, whether it's education, whether it's targeting the ultra poor. A lot of these actually needs to happen together. And even though I think what makes it even more complicated is that when some of these solutions that works in one country, then we try to go and replicate in another country, that's given it's even more complicated. Because the complexity of the social dimensions is so much different from one country to another. I mean, that's something we have learned at BRAC when we actually moved out of Bangladesh after 30 years of existence. We saw that our very successful girls' education program, when we tried to do that in Afghanistan, is a very, very conservative society. The approach that we had to take was completely different. And similarly, when we moved from Afghanistan to Uganda, the nature of the poverty was very, very different. The reasons were very, very different. I mean, we had the young teenagers plagued with pregnancy. And so the approach and the innovations were a lot more different than what we did in Bangladesh. But there are certain things that are sort of universal that seems to be working in the sector. So maybe we can highlight some of those today. First of all, the role of women in development. It has been a major, major sort of achievement. I mean, in terms of putting them at the center of development intervention has proved to be very, very successful. Give a dollar to a woman in the household, she would spend at least 70% of that for the children's education, the household, as opposed to a man who would probably who would actually spend 30 cents. That has been actually proven in a recent research that came out. And as a result, you know, there are also many other dimensions. I mean, that recent Lancet study that has come out, which actually shows that for every year for a schooling that a mother that gets, the child mortality rate on average goes down by 9.5% in a country. So an educated mother is actually a big reason for the child mortality to come down by almost half over the last 40 years. So putting women at the center of the intervention has been very, very effective over the last 30, 40 years that we have seen. However, not just in terms of intervention, what we have seen at BRAC that women are a very, very effective change agents as well. And they are extremely effective because their sense of sort of notion or commitment to the community, their acceptance in the community is very, very different compared to men. And one of the big part of the development, as we were talking about, is that, you know, it's not just about a technical solution, right? It's about norms change. It's about behavior change. And that takes years, and that's not an overnight game. So on those occasions, conversing with the household, you know, women are extremely effective. And on the other hand, the third one would be, it's not just the social angle of this. I mean, it actually makes, investing on women actually makes smart economics as well. A recent McKinsey study that has come out shows that if women were to get the same opportunity as men, their contribution to the global economy would be almost $28 trillion. That would be increased. I mean, that's almost the size of US and China economy put together. And in Bangladesh, we have seen that over the last 10 years, that within the labor force, they, from the age range 20 to 24-year-olds, the women's participation in the labor force has doubled. And actually, that has also contributed hugely to the garments boom in Bangladesh, which is now brings in about $24 billion every year for Bangladesh. The next one, I would say, is that the power of social network, the real social network, social network that we know. I mean, in a lot of cases, and starting with the microfinance in Bangladesh, the notion of these village organizations where women got together and discuss their issues, and this is this whole notion of kind of mobilization and conscientization has been a huge sort of a booster in terms of doing a lot of these future interventions that we did that started with microfinance. And as I was mentioning, poverty is not just about economic poverty, right? It's about poverty of confidence, poverty of hope. So when these groups are formed, when these actually work miracles, because not only people find similar who are like them, they are actually form an extremely effective peer group. That we have seen in Bangladesh. Similarly in Uganda, where we have formed these adolescent clubs with these teenagers, it's actually also proved very effective. It doesn't take much. It's not a rocket science solution. It is one community organizer who goes from household to household, identifies who's the adolescent girl, and basically asks them to convene twice or thrice at a place, given place every week. They play together, they bond, they learn something, and through this process, they actually form an immensely powerful bond, a powerful group that basically does lots of things are going forward. I mean, in terms of they have become very effective entrepreneur, managing their sort of household better, child in nutrition, and so on, so on. Even in our graduation program that I believe Dean will talk about a bit later, this is the ultra poor, which is at the very bottom tier of the poor. They are completely invisible from the social structure. And one of the interventions that we have is there, we actually have the community people. You see the picture. There's a mapping that goes on of the local village, where they identify where do these ultra-poor people live. That's actually selected by the community who's going to get those assets that will be transferred to them. Then a rural elite committee is set up to give them protection. So more than the asset transfer and the technical assistance that goes to the ultra-poor, this actually works as a huge booster for them, because suddenly this completely invisible group of people are part of this rural network again. And that gives them hope, and that gives them a confidence that they can make a difference. The second one, the last point I would like to make is about scaling. I think it's something that we need to talk more about. It's something, does the world need more innovation, or should we look at innovations that have worked and try to scale them up? Who's actually talking about scaling? Who's actually looking at the barriers to scale? What does it take to scale? And is the funders are actually investing on organizations who can scale effectively? I mean, yesterday, of course, we heard from the president of the Ford Foundation that institution building is going to be one of their major focus going forward, and they have reduced the number of sort of organizations they're going to fund. It's a welcome sign. But I think that's something more and more we need to highlight, that, you know, what are the solutions that are working? And has it been tested? Is there a well-formed evidence in terms of whether this replication actually works? And once we know that it works, let's put our heads together and identify how we can scale them across countries, across regions, and what are the learnings from it. I think that's something that is missing from the global talk agenda. So where does that leave us? I think this whole notion of the, we have basically just finished the Millennium Development Goal target in last year, 2015, and there also has been a lot of learning. Some countries have done really well, some countries have not done so well, but in terms of one thing that is commonly acknowledged, that this notion that the government is bad, private sector is good, and social sector is ineffective, all these notion actually doesn't work anymore. I mean, I think in order for us to effectively do successful innovation that can scale and solve these problems, we need them all. I think government is very good at scaling up. If the model is right and the scaling up happens, it's a great thing. Private sector comes with its efficiency and strong focus. And social sector is fantastic in terms of doing some of these social innovation, community mobilization, working on this behavior change and social norm change. So I think we need to work extremely closely together. But this is a cliche, but I mean, as the big question is how. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Asif. Dean, next.
Great. Hi, everybody. This is actually a very nice segue, because I'm going to talk about some of the things that feed directly into how Asif ended up. But I want to start off by making everybody feel a little bit better about the nonprofit sector. So let me show you something from the for-profit sector. Oh, well, not that slide. So here is how evidence can get used in the supposedly, quote, evidence-based medicine world, which is a world that we really do actually learn a lot from and emulate and are taking that kind of way of thinking, not this way of thinking, but the way of thinking of getting clear evidence on what drugs work and applying that same kind of thinking to ways of fighting poverty. But here's a study that was done by British Medical Journal, well, not by them, published in the British Medical Journal. They took 175 brochures from German advertisements from pharmaceutical companies to doctors, and found that 15% of these brochures advertising medicine in no way cited any research whatsoever to validate why that medicine was being advocated. 22% listed citations that could not be found. 6% contained scientifically supported facts, and the kicker, in case you're reading ahead, 63% contained information only mostly correctly connected with the relevant research article, but did not actually reflect the results from the research. This problem of connecting evidence to action and evidence to policy is not just something that we experience in the philanthropy sector. So when incentives are not aligned, there's a problem. And so that's the next point I want to make is, in a very broad sense, why is this a conversation to have about the need for evidence to decide what to do, the need for evidence to figure out how to use philanthropic capital better? Well, you know, I am an economist in training, and so one of the things that, you know, I'm kind of lose my license if I don't agree with is that markets work. But that's work with certain conditions that are present, right? And then the interesting part of life is figuring out when those conditions are not present and what to do about them. One of the basic things that makes markets work, though, is that when firms make money, they stay in business, and when firms lose money, they go out of business. This is a good thing, actually. Okay. But what makes that work is that cash is king. Cash and profits are what drive that basic system to work. But when you apply that thinking to the nonprofit sector, you have a very basic market failure. What determines whether a nonprofit stays in business? It's whether it's raising money and paying its bills and has the money. What determines whether a nonprofit succeeds in achieving its mission is not whether it raises money, it's whether it achieves its mission. But there's a disconnect here. In the for-profit world, those are perfectly aligned. In the nonprofit world, they are not. That's the fundamental problem we have. So in some sense, that's saying the problem is really with the donors, right? That there's donors out there that do not demand evidence. But the reality is that's easier said than done, right? There's lots of donors out there. No one in their right mind would ever say, I don't want to support effective charities. But it's a very another statement to say how exactly to go about doing that, what to demand, how much to spend on these things, et cetera. So one of the, what we've been kind of lucky to be a part of is this kind of wave that hit the world in development economics was to bring a different standard of evidence. And this started in the mid-90s. IPA started in 2002. And IPA Innovations for Poverty Action and MIT Jamil Poverty Action Lab have been kind of at the forefront of pushing out this basic idea that we can actually go, and for many things out there, not everything, but for many things out there, we can actually go and set up tests the same way the medical world would, and set up a randomized trial and understand what actually is the short run, medium run, and long run impact from different programs and policies. And sometimes it's testing whether something works, and sometimes it's just figuring out how to make it work better. You know, lots of different ways of doing this. But the basic idea is to not leave ourselves to just mere belief and rhetoric. It's easy to make things sound good. It's a whole other beast to actually get it right. And usually, whenever there's a polarizing debate, both sides are wrong. And usually, the answer is somewhere in the middle. And I think microcredit is the poster child for that statement. So when we looked at, if we left to our beliefs, we see, you know, wonderful quotes. Actually, this is a somewhat modest quote for microcredit on the left. There's far more ambitious quotes out there for the impact of microcredit. Here's from the United Nations 2005 Year of Microcredit, said microcredit has been changing people's lives and revitalizing communities. The first part of that is actually, the evidence supports that, changing people's lives. The second part is not supported by the evidence, revitalizing communities. But on the flip side, you had some disastrous stories that were coming out, arguing that microcredit not only wasn't good, but was actually doing disastrous things and was harmful to people. And so if we're left to our beliefs and rhetoric and anecdotes, both of these stories can be defended with anecdotes, but not in a way that actually gives you any sense of what really happened to people and communities as compared to what would have happened had these programs not happened. And so we've now seen about 7 randomized trials on microcredit, different forms, different ways of doing it, but 7 different studies and counting. There's a few that are kind of closely related, so the number is growing. And they're strikingly similar results, which is striking given how varied the contexts were and the programs were. And the results are actually very, very similar. And basically what was found is that it was helping some people establish small businesses, improving choices, manage some risk better. But not a single one of the studies found an average impact on income. And there were some that found some people were better off, but the average impact was not there. The other thing that was striking is that the original aim of microcredit was to reach the world's poorest, but one reality is that it doesn't usually reach the poorest. It reaches the poor, but not the poorest. And so those are two main takeaways, which leads us to the, okay, so what do you do with that? So I first, it's one thing that's not on the slide, is what I, the first thing I do with that is if I'm talking to an investor, I'm like totally enthusiastic. Like, go for it, do it, this is great. Do it carefully. There are the ones that were tested. We're not doing kind of egregious lending things, so you don't want to go into a kind of predatory lending. You want transparency, things like this. So there's kind of good protocols for how to be a lender to the poor. But as if you're an impact investor wanting to feel like you're investing in something and it's helping people who are poor, then this is great. For that matter, so is Walmart. So I don't see these as very different in that space. But it's not something that, as being done, justified a subsidy by any means, because there was not achieving what philanthropic capital aims to do. So for that, we look at two different areas. One is to say, well, how could we do this better? Are there other ways of doing microfinance that actually could have the type of impact that we as philanthropists want to see our money generating? And some of that might be R&D kind of expenditure, where maybe the long-run model is actually to fold it into the microcredit and let it be a for-profit venture. But the R&D that needs to take place does need a subsidy from the philanthropic sector. And in a sense, that's the history of microcredit. When you look at 30, 40 years ago, it started off as a nonprofit entity and entities. And it was philanthropically funded. And then they realized, wait a second, we're making money. And then things kind of shifted over and became for-profits. And in a sense, some of these other ideas on the left could be in that same model, that it might need philanthropic model money to push and innovate and do things like that. Kiva is actually a good example, I believe, of a group that is still sticking with its plain vanilla stuff, but has this thing called Kiva Labs on the side, which is being aggressive and innovative and trying new things and willing to take some losses, which is what a philanthropist should be willing to do. So some of those I'm not going to talk about are just about better credit models, savings, and insurance. The part I'm going to talk a little bit more about is to go back to the original goal. The original goal was raising income for the world's poorest. Okay, and so there we're going to look at a program, but I put the term in the quote in graduations because I haven't heard a better term yet. I'm not a big fan of the term graduation, even though I use it constantly because that's what it's called and people are starting to know the term. But graduation seems to imply that we are literally graduating people out of poverty, and that is an overly ambitious aspiration for anything. And that is not where the evidence lies. The evidence will show some really impressive impacts. But by no means are we taking 100 people who are in poverty and then 3 years later finding that they are out of poverty in the way we want to say graduate. But it does target the ultra poor with an integrated program. This is the program that Asif mentioned, that Brock is one of the implementers of this program. So the graduation model is an integrated model that basically says, look, the problem with being poor is not any one thing. If it was so simple as being capital, then microcredit would have solved this. If it was so simple as information, well, we would have seen a million training programs just totally sweep things away and make the world better. If it was about health, we would have seen health programs. If any one of these components was actually like just the answer, well, then we would have seen these problems solved long ago. And so the idea is that maybe the problem is multifaceted for an individual household, and if you don't solve many of the constraints at once, well, then you don't solve the problem. So we started off with just a kind of sufficient argument. Is it sufficient if we do all of these components together to generate some long-term sustainable increases in income and consumption? So the components start off, the heart of it is an asset, like for goats, beekeeping, guinea pigs, things like this. Usually it's animals in most of the countries that we tested this in. We've seen now studies in 7 sites. So I'm part of the first 6, Ethiopia, Ghana, Honduras, India, Pakistan, Peru. These were pulled together in one paper that we published in Science about a year ago. The Bangladesh is the Brock site, which is published separately by different co-authors, all finding the same basic result. Actually, not Honduras. I'll explain that in a second. So the heart is an asset that is usually always a productive asset and usually an animal, but not always. But then things along with it, some consumption support. So they don't immediately slaughter the animal to eat it. So 6 months of consumption support. Some training, some life coaching. So this is a very behavioral motivated idea that there are many issues that arise and helping to build hope and aspiration and planning for that household is necessary through kind of constant interaction from an NGO in the field. That's an area that's actually particularly expensive. I think we have a lot to learn about how to do that part better. Access to some health, access to a financial account for savings. So it was all integrated as one package. And what do we find? This is the pooled of the 6 sites that I was a part of. The striking thing here is one of the most common issues when you do, as a researcher, when we're reading papers and when we're producing papers ourselves, is a lot of times interventions say, well, no, I think I'm going to have an impact on this and this and this and this and this and 10 different things and 20 different things. And one of the problems as a researcher, and I say this as one who reads a paper as well as writes them, is when you have 20 different outcomes that you're looking at, it's sometimes hard to know, well, what do you do when you have four that came up good and 16 did not? At what point do you tip over and say, this is working, right? And so this is called the multiple hypothesis problem in academia, that how do you adjust for thinking about that? Because we know that randomly something's going to pop up, right? So kind of if you think about 95% confidence intervals, that says like 5% of the time, you just, you know, by luck get something to work. So if you have enough things that you measure, something eventually works. And you don't want to then all of a sudden conclude that it turns out like this program is just amazing for that one outcome when it was just luck. The striking thing here is we don't have to worry about that, because here's 10 different outcomes and it worked on all 10. And it's just not that common that we see that. Now, again, I want to go back to a point earlier. Just because we're seeing impacts across the spectrum of the types of things that we care about in someone's life, that doesn't mean this is a panacea, right? But it is the case that we're seeing just systematic improvements across many facets of life. So consumption, household assets, food security, total amount borrowed, I wouldn't call good or bad. That's just an observation to note what is happening so we can understand. But we don't think of that as good or bad. Savings, I do think of as unambiguously good. Total time spent working, physical health, mental health, political index. Total time spent working also is not unambiguously good, but for people who are in this level, it is. As you get wealthier, obviously leisure can be is a luxury good. So what hopefully you're all saying to yourself right now is, well, those were the benefits, but what did it cost? Because like, if you spend $1 million a household, who cares, right? So here's all the benefits divided by the costs. And for the six sites, the 100% mark is what we want to be above in order to justify and say this is a good idea. And as you can see, for 5 out of 6 of the countries, the benefits are higher than the costs of the program. Honduras did not work. In Honduras, the asset were chickens that got sick and died. So it was a very important lesson about that, you know, that the asset is potentially the linchpin of the whole thing. And you get that wrong, everything else was there, you get that wrong and it didn't work. And so a lot of it, one does need to be careful. It was a new breed of chicken that they thought was going to work, and it turned out it just didn't work, and it was costly to take care of. So that's the result of this, and we're now spending a lot of time on scale-up and technical assistance to try to figure out how to bring this to scale and to what parties, to government social protection programs. But this is a philanthropy conference, so hopefully you're thinking to yourself, wonderful, but how do I know where to give? So, you know, let's take Brock as an example. I hope you don't mind me using this in this way. You know, Brock has $1 billion in revenues, as you just noted. If I'm a donor and I want to support this program, it's not so obvious where to give. Brock has many programs. Where is it going to go? Right? This was done by Plan in 2 countries. Same thing. If I send money to Plan, where will it go? The other countries where it was done were not organized by 501c3s. Where would you send your money if all you want to do is do this? So one of the things that we are incubating, and Kevin Starr over here is actually on the board of this new organization that I just started called Impact Matters. And Impact Matters is trying to address 2 issues. It's trying to address that first issue for donors. How do I find nonprofits that use and produce appropriate evidence of impact? So that might be organizations that are not running randomized trials like I just showed you, but are doing exactly what has evidence behind it. And so they're taking ideas from elsewhere and saying, that has strong evidence, the setting is appropriate, and I'm going to roll that out. Or it might be the organization that ran the randomized trial as well. Or it might be, and we haven't gotten in there yet, but we will work to get to advocacy programs that are outside the space, perhaps, of what a randomized trial can do. And then we'll be looking at whether they're using appropriate evidence for what they're doing. The second part of what we aim to do, though, is to actually help nonprofits improve how well they can use and produce appropriate evidence themselves. So this is a short-run engagement to give them advice on and to help feed the research that's out there that they might not be aware of to their organization so that they know more about what has been learned from the rest of the world. So we've done 4 audits now. We launched these in 2015, very much in beta phase, so eager for feedback from people. We're still in our tinkering R&D phase. In fact, yesterday we had a board meeting and really went through a lot of details and revamped our standards and protocols, and we'll be launching another set in the next 6 months. The four that we released are Trickle Up, BOMA Project, Success for All, and Possible. Success for All is a domestic charity that works on literacy. Possible does health work in Nepal. And Trickle Up and BOMA both do similar programs for the graduation in developing countries. And so the goal is very much two-pronged. It is to provide feedback to donors, but it's also to help the organizations as well learn how to use and produce appropriate evidence. Okay, so then, what are the returns to investments to knowledge? One of the things that we often face in this space is this question of what is the using research to, or using evaluation to look backwards and say, like, how did we do? And that's often the way we hear evaluation being posed, is as a tool to understand whether my $1 million grant produced good or not. And, you know, I think the way that we need to think about this is by asking ourselves, what are the big ideas that are out there that we need evidence behind? What is the proposition, the value from having better knowledge on that, in that space? And what is the cost to getting to that? And then whether, you know, the cost of the existing programs is almost irrelevant for that. What really matters is what can be had in the future. So we did an exercise where we tried to think it through the impact on ourselves. And by ourselves, I mean the, you know, the collection of the research that has been done. And I think this is, there's an important backstory that I want you to have on this, which is, you know, randomized trials are not meant for every situation. And, you know, yes, that is the heart of what we do, but by no means would you catch anybody who runs randomized trials claiming that randomized trials should be applied to everything. And the deeply ironic joke is that it doesn't apply to us, except to a very, you know, you can think of small little things you could do when, like, fundraising experiments to see if people respond to evidence, but that's a kind of a small little piece of it. The big picture idea as to whether or not the research on evidence has actually had an impact. You can't actually do a randomized trial realistically on the big picture of that. That, you have to think about it more. And so the approach we took to this is thinking about it like a venture capitalist. Okay, so you made lots of investments, and then let's look at each of the investments and let's see whether policy has changed in that domain. And then let's ask the question at the end, what proportion of this do we think can be attributed to the costs of, in this case, IPA. So here's like the four of the six or seven that are the key scale-up cases. We've seen about 500 projects take place and that have led to about six to eight really big areas where we've pushed forward a lot of scale-up. BedNets, this is research that was done by Pascaline Dupas and Jessica Cohen. Pascaline Dupas is a professor here at Stanford. That basically did some very nice careful tests about the policy of whether to sell or give BedNets away for free, which led to massive changes in the policies around the world for selling versus giving away for free. So that we, when we look at the impact of that on the actual number of people who then are using BedNets, we calculate a $10 billion benefit to the world. The graduation program is very young, so the number is very small and the costs are high because the program costs a lot. But the hope is that in 10 years, that number will be much bigger because it's right at the very, very beginning of the scale-up process. Teaching at the level of students, this is a program that we've tested now in four different places and have taken to scale in several states of India and countries, where it's changing the way literacy programs are basically, in numeracy is being taught at young students. And deworming is another program which we have done some of the research which helped establish the effectiveness of deworming school children for improving school attendance and actually increasing earnings 10 years later by doing long-term tracking. So you add this all together, and what we get is a total benefit of 24 billion. Oops, we're missing the number. The denominator, but the numerator is 24.2 billion is the total benefits from this evidence in terms of policies that have changed behind each of these pieces of evidence. The total costs across all projects, like I said, take the venture capitalist mindset here, right? This includes the losers that didn't lead to anything, was about $310 million. So that leads to a multiplier of about 79 to 1. For every dollar invested in this type of research, we can count $79 of total benefits that change. Now, the question is, of course, like I said, we don't have a counterfactual. This is not randomized evidence here. So how much of that credit does the research get versus changes that may have happened anyhow or may have happened through other entities? And our feeling is that even if we get half the credit or a third the credit or a tenth of the credit, it's still actually a winning ratio. particularly given that it's just the infancy of it. So this is the mindset that I think one should take to research. And the key is to really thinking about where the gaps are. Frankly, this leads to the very last point I want to make, which is going to say maybe the exact opposite message that you think you're just hearing. You might have a message from this, okay, the guy's a researcher and he's promoting research. But now I'm going to tell you to do less. So what should donors demand and what data should organizations collect? And here, one of the things that we offer, and this is and the key thing to think about is, where are the gaps? Don't do this for accountability purposes. If that's the reason it's being done, you're spending too much money on research and monitoring. And so you should spend less. Do it when there's a gap in knowledge. And you say, no, I don't know the answer to this question. I don't know if this is working or not. And other people are doing this too, and we should really find out. And that's when you should be spending the money. Not when you just want to know whether your money had an effect. Because you in that particular organization in that particular way. So we have a new book that's probably going to come out in about 6 to 12 months called The Goldilocks Challenge that puts forward 4 principles for how to think about whether data should or should not be collected. And then we're calling it The Goldilocks Challenge because it's a pushback on a world that says more and more data, great, how can it be bad? It's cheap, it's free. And it's a pushback on that space that seems to want data for the sake of data. But of course, we don't think too little is probably the wrong answer too. It doesn't mean the middle option is always best. But the 4 principles are credible. It should be high quality data, and the analysis should be credible. It should be that if you're claiming this is a causality, that it actually has a counterfactual. It actually has some establishment of what would have happened had you not done what you did. The data ought to be actionable. It ought to be that there is a state of the world in which you get the data back and you change a decision. If it's the case that all data lead to the same decision, then you shouldn't be collecting the data in the first place. So I've seen many a situation where if data come in, people are going to feel happy. And if data is a certain way, they'll feel happy. Great, we should keep doing what we're doing. And if data come in another way, they say, well, the data were wrong. If that's the case, then don't collect the data. Responsible. Some data are very expensive. And sometimes maybe the knowledge gap isn't there, and so don't collect it. And transportable. This one's more of an aspirational one. There are some situations where maybe that's not always going to be fit. But the idea of transportable is if it's knowledge, you should be able to collect data in a way that actually can help not only you in the future, but other organizations and other places. And so my last slide, similar to Asif, is a cartoon. So one of our cartoons that went in the book is this cartoon about someone who basically collected too much data without really thinking through what to do with it all. I want to impress upon you that we need to be thinking through how we're actually going to be using the data that we're demanding of organizations, making sure that there's actually a path to action that's sensible and responsible. So with that, I'll jump down. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks very much, Dean. And now for our last presenter, Kevin Starr.
How's that? Want me to start over? Here, I'll start over. So I did stumble into philanthropy some years ago, and I didn't know anything. And I started the first few years going all over the world, looking at a lot of stuff, trying to figure out what really worked. And I noticed 3 big things. One was that nobody seemed to be measuring impact, so it was hard to figure out what worked. And another was that things weren't really designed for impact. They seemed to be kind of a collection of activities that were a good idea at the time. And the third thing was that things weren't really run along the principles that had worked so well in business. And given that I had gone to a hippie college and a leftist medical school, if I noticed that, it was pretty obvious. But the thing I really learned was this: a good idea needs a good organization. Now that seems pretty obvious, but early on a friend of mine said to me, the social sector is like a graveyard where successful pilots go to die. And clearly he needed a new line of business, but in truth, if you look at it, in Silicon Valley, if I have a good idea that could make a lot of money, I gotta hide it from everybody. I gotta patent protect it. It's gotta be mine until I can really roll it out. It doesn't really work like that in the social sector. We don't have a market for impact. And so you can you can publish a really great idea and it'll sit gathering dust on the shelves for years. And what we learned the hard way was a good idea doesn't really get anywhere and doesn't really get to scale unless somebody creates some organization to really make sure it happens. And so if you think about it, a good idea needs a good organization. We've been talking about good ideas and good organizations. The role of the funder becomes kind of clear. Our job is to find great organizations and fund them, advise them, maybe. And the reason I say maybe is because the best advice I ever got in philanthropy was really early on, one of my board members took me aside and he goes, "Kevin, now that you're a funder, people will tell you you're a genius." And then he looked me right in the eye and he said, "You are not a genius." And so we have to be careful with that one, but the other one is connect. We need to take the people who we funded and connect them to resources. And the biggest resource we need to connect them with is other funders, because we're the best people to do that. And if we don't do it, nobody will. So the way that we do this at Mulago is we're focused on a basic need of the very poor. We're very clear on what our mission is. And we're looking for scalable ideas that have real impact, delivered by an organization that has a team that can really deliver that. And so the first step in figuring that out is understanding the organization's mission. Because we're looking for something overall that can go to scale. If you're wondering what scale is, it's BRAC. We're not looking for this. Incremental change won't save the world. Ultimately, this will. And so the first thing Mulago has to do as we try to figure that out is understand the mission of the organization we're looking at and does it fit with ours. Now, the typical mission statement doesn't really do anything for us. We want a mission statement in 8 words or less. And I don't know why it's 8, it just seems to work. We want a verb, we want a target population, and we want an outcome. So Living Goods is an organization that has an Avon Lady-like network of women who go door to door selling critical health products, doing health education, and making referrals. This is what they set out to do. This is what they're still doing. One Acre Fund bundles together all the ingredients a farmer needs to make a better living, the inputs, the credit to get them, and the training to do it right. They're very clear on what they're trying to do. Stoves are a really good example of why a mission is super important. So people ascribe all kinds of missions to stoves. They're going to prevent deforestation. They're going to prevent CO2 emissions. They're going to save women labor. They're going to save families money. They're going to improve health. And they usually give you a stove and just say, "Bleh, here it is." That's all the stuff it does. It's hard to optimize for all those things. The one that matters most to us is health, because indoor pollution is the third leading cause of death and disability in the world. So that's the mission we care about. That's the mission we're looking for, not trying to drive in an organization, but looking for an organization that already has that. The next thing we ask, once we know the mission, is what's impact look like? And the question we ask that's really useful for us is, if you could only determine one thing that let you know you fulfilled your mission, what would that be? So for example, income from crops. For example, child mortality. For example, respiratory disease prevented. And when you know that just one thing, you can start diving into the science. For example, here's a graph that's super important for stoves. What it says is that if you're trying to reduce the risk of cardiovascular mortality, you need to remove almost all the pollutants. It turns out the vast majority of stoves don't do that. You need the more expensive forced draft stoves. That makes a huge difference. That's a huge bummer for the Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves and others that have been working on this for a long time in good faith. Most of their stoves don't work. So we have a big portfolio of stuff, and we try to get systematic about how to measure. And so we look for four things. We want to understand what an organization set out to do. We already talked about the mission. We want to measure the right thing, something that really gets at that just what one thing if it can't be measured directly. We want to get good numbers so that things are measured using the right sample size and the right interval and the right timing. It's a before and after that really works. The survey methods are good. And then maybe the most important thing, we ask people, how do you know it was you? In other words, because your impact is what happened with you minus what happened without you. That's hard. And we ask people to make a persuasive case for it. And I'll say that we're doing this systematically for everybody in our portfolio. It ain't perfect anywhere. It's a work in progress, but everybody we work with is working toward that, and we hold ourselves to the discipline of working toward that. We do a lot of startups, so sometimes we don't have great impact data yet, but we have to try to predict it. And so what we use is a tool we call behavior mapping, where we try to connect the dots all the way to impact. So if you look at a stove, what has to happen to get to that impact of healthier families? They got to get a stove. They got to get the right fuel for the stove. They got to use the stove exclusively. It turns out that people don't just use that nice stove you gave them. They'll use whatever stoves they need. Sometimes they'll have three or four different fires going one time. You have to make sure they use only good stoves if you want to get the benefit. They have to start it right, because even the best stoves are smoky at the beginning. They have to ventilate, because even the best stove in a closed room will asphyxiate you. And if it breaks, they got to get it fixed. That's what has to happen for a stove to work. We want to map out all those behaviors for a startup and say, okay, what do you do to make those all happen? And systematically, we're asking, have you created the conditions for each of those behaviors so they can happen? And you've made sure the incentives are there so that they will happen. Can happen, will happen. Can happen, will happen. So we invested in a stove company in Rwanda called Inyenyeri, who has a solution that met all those conditions for us. For example, these stoves that they have to use cost $80. No one's going to buy an $80 stove, so they essentially give them away. They lease them to people for $7 a year. And then they sell them the pellets to burn in it at a kiosk that's not too far away and at a price that's just a little less than charcoal. If people want more than one, they can have them. So people are getting up to three stoves, poor people. Each comes with a contract to buy X amount of pellets. They have handles so you can start it outdoors and bring it in. They badger people to put the stove near a door or window, but they're also creating a really low-cost hood with a fan to make sure the air gets out. And when it breaks, they fix it or they replace it. So we're really comfortable that if they execute well, if the unit economics work out, they can deliver. So what is scale, and how do we figure out if something is, in fact, scalable? There's two big questions that we ask. The first is, who's the doer? You're an organization, you've figured out how to do this thing, you R&D'd it, you validated it, you're ready to scale it up, you want to think about scale at 1 million, 10 million, beyond. The critical question, we've gotten really disciplined about asking this early for people, is who's the doer at scale? There's only four choices. It's either you building a really big NGO or a really big business. It's lots of NGOs replicating your model. It's lots of businesses replicating your model. Or it's the government delivering it through policies and programs. That's it. Pick one. And then the next question is, if you know your doer, who's your payer? Because somebody has to pay for this at scale. And again, there's four, which is convenient. There's customers, there's taxes, there's big aid, because even directly through NGOs or governments, it's often big aid paying for this, or it's private philanthropy. Pick one and design for it. So for example, Living Goods, right now, what they think is ultimately they're going to deliver their model through lots of NGOs, which means they've got to shift at some point from being primarily a doing institution to a teaching institution. The payer isn't entirely clear. There may be a role for taxes, and it's probably going to be big aid for the foreseeable future. One Acre Fund so far has gotten this curve doing it themselves, but that's going to hit a ceiling, and then they know that others are going to have to replicate their model. They're going to be paid for by big aid. They've already gotten past private philanthropy, and they're in institutional funding land. Where it goes beyond that, I'm not quite sure. Inyanyeri is a for-profit company. They've got ambitions to scale up throughout Rwanda. What we believe and we hope and we want to see is that others see how well their model works and copy it in a profitable business. So once you do know your doer payer, then it's pretty simple to look at what scalable means. One is it broadly applicable enough? Are there enough settings where this really would work for it to be applicable and hence scalable? Is it simple enough that your doer could do it? Is it cheap enough that your payer would pay it? And even when governments set out to fund a community health worker program, they have a price point. They have a per capita coverage that the finance minister, not the health minister, really cares about. So once we think we have a scalable solution, what does it mean to deliver it? And a lot of people in this room know more about what a good company looks like than I do. But there are several things we look for. We look for, obviously, the track record is the best indicator of what's ahead. The senior team and whether they can iterate on incoming information, know when to pivot when they have to, and attract money and talent? And do they have the systems in place so they can really iterate and they can know what's going on and they can improve their performance over time? Those are the things we look at. And as a funder, we try to do the best funding job we can when we see that. So our core principles are, just pounding this one home, organizations, not projects. We only fund people who measure because we can't measure. And what we look for really is a culture of measurement, not do they do a good job of measuring for the donors, but are they doing a good job of measuring for themselves so they can get better? We only give unrestricted funding. We figure if they don't know how to make best use of the money, we shouldn't give them any. And we stick with them because there isn't a market for impact. We can't just hand them off to a reliable market that'll drive them to scale. We and our partners need to stick with them. So what's the role for funders in all this, in fighting poverty? It really is that we need to get serious about funding for impact. We need to be the ones driving market forces that efficiently channel resources toward the organizations that know how to create impact best. We need to commit to impact and be accountable for it. It'd be great if people like me got fired for not having enough impact. I don't know if it's ever happened. We need to understand impact well enough to go looking for it, and we need to actually do a good job of funding for it. Because we're not the geniuses. The CEO knows how to hire. The engineer who designed that cool thing that saves lives. Even the fundraiser who knows how to separate rich people from their money so everybody's happy. Those are the geniuses. All we do is write checks. And if we know how to do that one thing really well, we can help set in motion a big wave of change. Thanks.
I want to kick it off with just a couple questions and then quickly turn it over to you, the audience. So get ready to get up to the mics to ask your questions. There was a couple threads that ran through all your presentations. Probably the one that jumped out at me the most was the importance of measuring impact and having that drive decision-making by nonprofits, by funders, and having it be measurements that can actually inform practice rather than just tell you what, you know, in the rearview mirror you did, whether it worked or not. There's a general understanding of that the importance of that, and organizations that, you know, like BRAC and organizations that you fund and work with do that well, but as you all know, so many don't. So many organizations don't do that. So many funders don't use that. Government policymakers, certainly, you know, it's hard to say that they operate rationally in that way. So what do you see that are the barriers to getting people to really have that be part of their practice? And what can we do to overcome them? So let me just throw it to Asif, given that you've, you know, your organization does that really well. You do work with government, yeah. Large aid organizations, et cetera.
I think the biggest barrier is ambition. I think a lot of the organizations do pilots for the sake of pilots, but not keeping in mind that it's actually a means to an end, which is that I want to scale up my impact in a big way and do it in a ambitious way. That it should be scalable. So a lot of it, as Kevin pointed out, so who's doing it? I think one thing in the social sector, which I find it missing, basically particularly coming from also a private sector background, when a venture capitalist actually invests in a company, they look at the entrepreneur. They actually see how entrepreneurial, how risk-taker this person is. But in the social sector, we look at a proposal. Basically, somebody who can write good English and use all the right buzzwords, they basically get the best funding in some ways, let alone whether this actually is a person who can take risks and not averse to failure and learning from failure. So that's something I think it's a bit mystifies me a lot. And again, taking a cue from Kevin's presentation, the funders have a huge responsibility here on funding those initiatives which actually has that ambition to scale. And obviously, in terms of, I also am very heartened by it to see that Gavin also does unrestricted funding. I mean, I think BRAC also were lucky that in the last few years got a lot of unrestricted funding where we could plan a lot of these initiatives in a way that we could think big. And the other issue is, of course, when you plan for scale, you also need to build up the infrastructure ahead of time. Do you? And again, this is focusing on the institution, focusing on the building the organization. Do you have the? I mean, our research and evaluation department was built up like 2 years after the organization was founded, when the organization was very small in 1975. So there was a constant culture of looking at iteratively: are we having any impact? Are we making a difference? And again, this was not done to satisfy the donors. It was basically to see whether there is real impact happening. There's this very critical culture of self-evaluation that happens within the organization. And when you do that, when you also start thinking ahead, you basically plan ahead, you create the distribution channel across the country, and so that when the next pilot, when you actually have successfully done it, you kind of trim the fat, make it very cost-effective, efficient, and then you have the distribution channel to kind of push it out. So there's a huge focus on training the staff, basically creating that culture of doing delivery. So it's almost like a science. So I think that's some of the things. I think we get caught up too much on the narrative, the storytelling, the anecdotal stories. So yeah, I don't know.
Dina, I mean, so, your IPA has done an amazing job of measuring lots of things, but then, you know, has it had the impact that you would hope on decision making, both by the nonprofits, by governments, by funders?
So I'll answer that question first, and then we'll go back to your first question. The answer on that one is, to be honest with you, I'm kind of giddy at what I've seen happen. I mean, and the thing I'm single most proud about IPA is just who the people are that I got involved, because I've done, that's the only thing I really can claim credit for. But the policy wonking advocacy work that we did that generated that 79-to-1 ratio, I'm giddy about. Having said that, that's tiny compared to the world. So this now the answer to your first question, because I don't think I don't think asking what has IPA done answers your first question. We are a smidgen of the world, and there is a massive world out there that isn't being moved. And so I think, my sense on the first question, I think we have some similar themes in the answer. The first is that there is a push that needs to happen from funders. So then the question is, why doesn't this happen? And I have kind of one personality answer and one psychology answer. A personality answer, one of the things that I find, to be perfectly blunt, when I get introduced sometimes in conferences, I get a little uncomfortable because people like play up like, oh, I must, Yale professor, I must know so much. And the reality is, I feel like I've accomplished what I have accomplished only because of one thing. I'm self-aware of how little I know. And so I go off and I try to learn these things and I try to set up tests because I don't know. Like there's an idea and two people are shouting about whether it's left or right. And I'm like, I don't know. So let's go find out. And that's all I've done. Right. So, and yet, the Yale professor has this kind of halo effect that I think sends the wrong message. But there's a lot of people out there that don't take that attitude and say, no, I think it's left. And they just go for it. And it's like, it's left. And it's like, well, wait, where's the evidence for that? But if you have that strong personality that's driving something and convincing other people to follow along, well, then that's where the money flows. So that's the kind of a personality thing about kind of, strong leaders, if they're just have good, strong rhetoric behind them. And the other is a psychology reason, which is the we are moved by narratives and pictures and photos and, well, I guess that's the same thing. And people and interaction in that way. And we're not usually, we're not moved as much by data. That requires sitting down and thinking. It's a different process within our mind. And it's not to say that no money moves that way, but a lot of times money is moved and inspired and motivated by the stories. And unfortunately, the stories don't, can be told every which way. So we do have to, we have to take a step back oftentimes and let the stories motivate us and inspire us and bring us to action and say, this is what compels us to want to do something. But the stories shouldn't be what then help us choose over which of three seemingly good ideas are the right ones to do. For that one, I want to see data.
So, Kevin, I'd like you to answer that question too. But after he does, I'd like to open it up to the audience. So if you could please, if you have questions, get up to the mics.
I forgot what the question was.
Well, the thread that really I saw through all your comments was the importance of evidence in driving decision making, and it seems obvious, and I think to everybody in this room it does, but as we all know, so many organizations, government policymakers and funders don't use that to inform their decision making. And what are the barriers to that, and how do we get people to do it? You described well, kind of how you arrived at that. Is it just sort of the responsibility of every philanthropist to similarly go through that journey? Or have you, you've probably made efforts to try to get other funders to adopt your approach?
Well, I think the single biggest thing we could do to drive all this is to make funders accountable for impact. So imagine what it would look like if foundation executives like me knew that their next raise or even keeping their job dependent on being to demonstrate that they had more impact than the other guy. You'd have executives beating the bushes everywhere, scrounging ruthlessly for who had the most impact, and that would ripple down through the whole industry where people who could really drive good impact would get paid a lot more, and we just see all kinds of changes. And that's it. That creates a market for impact, and that changes everything.
It's interesting you say that, because yesterday Darren Walker, I think, turned to Rob and said, hold me responsible for the work that we're doing. So I think we have maybe a new model here, and it'll be interesting, to have
the actual executives. He didn't say hold me responsible for impact. I was kind of waiting for that one.
But, you know, there could be, I guess, how do you, I mean, it sounds good, but is there a way to actually translate that into, you know, that your next raise would be dependent on that, or that there's somehow we can create organizations that do provide that kind of oversight over foundation executives?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, the first step would be we at least get embarrassed if we don't have impact. It's a way between that and getting fired, but we're working on it.
I mean, this SSIR, the spring edition that just came out, we actually have a 16-page supplement on basically issue, wrote about scaling. It's, again, six articles where different organizations who have done successful scale-up and also some academics have identified some of the barriers and challenges and what works. So I think it's going to be a very good read who are interested in scaling.
Thanks. Yeah, I thank you for that plug. It is true. It is in our latest issue, which I think we have copies out there. And if not, it's available online. First question here.
Sure. My name's Debbie Hall, and I'm on the board of a group called Village Enterprise. My question is that the science study on graduation programs last year created a lot of excitement. My question is, what other things are coming down the pike that you think we have the opportunity to learn a lot from? You know, what studies are you excited about? Of course, as you know, Dean, you're running a study for Village Enterprise looking at the graduation program plus a couple of key variations on that. And I understand. No, so if you could elaborate on that.
That was going to be my answer, though.
Oh, good, good. Well, I'll let you answer it. I'm not answering that. And then I understand you're about to launch or are launching a longer 10-year evaluation of pure cash interventions. Mm. Thanks.
The thing with the Village Enterprise that is interesting to compare the graduation is because it has a very similar approach, but it is stripping out some of the components. So I think one of the main questions with graduation that gets asked, there's a few, but one of them is, can it be done cheaper? Are all these components necessary? And so the study with Village Enterprise is comparing cash to a more stripped down version of the program. I think one of the things that I'm fairly excited about are things that are on the psychosocial side. There's a lot of situations where, even take the graduation program that I showed you. What I didn't show you is a different slide, which showed the heterogeneity in returns to the households. And what we found was, even though the average impact was good, and even the people who were helped the least were helped, so everybody was good, right? It wasn't like it was some people were harmed and the average was still positive. But some people were helped a lot. And some people were just helped a bit. Why the difference? It's not so easy to predict. It wasn't just blue-haired people did well and brown-haired people didn't, and there you go. So it was very hard to predict. So the idea is that something is probably happening on more psychosocial elements, people's ability to seize opportunities and deal with it. It could be about female power and bargaining in the household. It could be about hope and aspiration and mental health. So we have one study in Ghana that is running cognitive behavioral therapy alongside the ultra poor program, the graduation program. So we're getting to see whether that helps the program. People seize that opportunity. We have a study in the Philippines, which is now about, it's a halfway point, in which we have, a similar program to graduation that is being run by a faith-based organization that works through a pastor network, adding on pastor kind of Bible study. And we're seeing whether that complements the program or not, because some of their hope is to have secular benefits, building hope and aspiration for households. So that's a very different study than our normal study, to be clear. But it's, you know, kind of in that spirit of psychosocial interventions and understanding how some of those can help complement and help bring up the ones that are not being helped as much.
Next question.
Tony Gannon from Small Foundation in Dublin, Ireland. We've been looking at projects, and we've seen some great projects in Africa, etc., around the world. But then we get very disappointed when it comes to the scaling. And one of the questions I have, and it's very relevant to Stanford because it's all about culture, my observation seems to be that the culture of the NGOs isn't hardwired for market-driven solutions or business-driven solutions. And we find that's a real problem. Now, the exception there, I see you're from executive director from Goldman Sachs, but that's not the norm. So when you were saying earlier, would you back the entrepreneur? Most of these people I wouldn't back. I wouldn't hire them in my business to do. They're very good people, but they're operators rather than developers. So I'm just wondering, is that a problem you see, and how can you get sort of business people into this sector particularly people are maybe the motivation's right to get that type of business people in.
Kevin?
The business people don't enter the social sector because the pay is crappy, mostly. And the management isn't as good. So people who are used to being paid well and managed well get there and they're not attracted to it. When they get there, they don't often like it that much. And again, if we were really rewarding impact, we would be able to pay people better. Like if somebody was really good and they were really good in an organization that could show very high cost effectiveness, they should get paid a lot more. A lot of business people we find are entering the social sector after they've made their money. I don't recommend that as a course because most people who put it off end up in a life path where they don't re-enter it. But it happens quite a bit. Overall, we're seeing way better management in the social sector. It lags a little bit behind, but we're seeing it, and we're seeing smarter investors in the social sector all the time. So I think we'll get there.
Asif, you're an example of somebody who went from the business sector to nonprofit.
Yeah, I attest to that. It's a crap pay. Definitely. It's a huge compromise in terms of quality of life. But compared to the gratification, I'm basically saying all the time, I'm making amends for my past sins. So working at BRAC. But I think one thing I observe is that there are lack of good managers in the social sector. And that's not because of that there aren't trained or anything like that. It's just the dynamics have been so skewed for such a long time. With the talk that Kevin gave, he's a minority in the funders world, right? I mean, it's driven by different sets of incentives. So they were never sort of incentivized to perform in a way which would reward more efficiency and impact, impact-driven culture. I think what I can attest for BRAC, and I've worked with also UN organizations, it's principally the entrepreneur himself who basically created that culture. And he was himself the founder of BRAC, a chartered accountant. He worked in Shell Oil. He was also from private sector. And he's a numbers guy. He's a numbers guy, but at the same time, he has an incredible social awareness but at the core of it, it's also about operational effectiveness. And I think that's also kind of trickle down in the organizational culture. So yes, I would say that there is a need to get more sort of business-like precision and focus within the organization. But at the same time, I should warn, that's not also the only solution. I mean, this is not just about everything in development is not set in stone that black and white impact is going to come after you do X and Y. Like I was saying in my talk, that there's a behavioral change aspect, there is a norms change aspect, there's a mobilization aspect, which also are not so much black and white. There's a lot of gray areas around those as well. So which also requires the kind of social mindset that sometimes is missing in the business side.
Yeah. Question?
Hi, Rebecca Butcher. I run The Mine, which is a social entrepreneurship organization in Tulsa. In our community, so I'm both funded by generous family foundations and work very closely alongside them, and am very, very blessed to also work within an organization that's extremely data-driven and in an ecosystem where funders want that data. I was wondering, from a funding perspective, the culture of your role, I guess, if you will, where is the line between being a funder and being a programs driver? So advising organizations, advising programs, encouraging impact. Is there a line from funding a program to having your hands so deeply in it that you are actually the one running the program?
I think that's meant for Kevin.
The line is, are you trying to be a doer by proxy, right? I mean, we're funders, they're doers. We should fund, they should do. If we have useful less, like we see a ton of stuff, right? We've seen a lot of the same mistakes. We've seen a lot of the same things done well. We've seen examples from conservation that are relevant for poverty in or for health somewhere else. We've seen organizational innovations that made sense over here that might be helpful. That's what we can be helpful at. Trying to drive their strategy, trying to mess with their model. If it's not good already, then we shouldn't get involved. It's not our job. It's an opinion.
Question over here.
Yes, hi. I'm Bjork Palsetter from the Training for Health Equity Network. We're trying to shift, actually look at the impact of institution, which is a very complex thing. And we're excited that people are looking at impact valuation, but what we're looking at is complex and takes a long time to look at. So we're struggling in finding funders that are willing to look 5 years, 10 years down the line and look at areas that are messy. You know, institutional change takes a lot of things, but you know, we're able to find sort of interim impact, but how can we get funders to think of systemic change and be willing to, you know, take risks that some of these things maybe, you know, aren't working?
We find that rarely is it that we can't sit down and do your mission and your just one thing and your behavior map and not identify things that could be measured in timely fashion that could give us a sense if you're really on target. Things aren't as messy as people often think, and if they stay messy, they're probably too messy.
You're trying to change the way institutions operate and how they measure success. So that actually academic institution kind of move out of the ivory tower and say, you know, what is the impact we have on communities? So some of it is around how they make decisions. Some of it may be around who they select into the program, maybe around curriculum. So there's a lot of factors. And often when you're looking at the impact, there's very many confounding factors. So the issue is, you know, we also need to look at the things that are hard to measure. And sometimes I feel that the impact focus tend to be on sort of just the low-hanging fruits and not as much on what's really hard to measure.
Well, I'm going to get a sense of what these guys have to say on that, but I honestly think that advocacy and policy change groups have gotten kind of a pass in terms of impact. And it's sort of the first question is, who do you want to do what differently? And how could you identify that? And you can observe that and you can measure that, and that's fine.
Yeah, Dean?
So he already said the phrase I was going to say, and I think I actually got it from him, so there's a reason why he said it first. Who do you want to have do what differently? If you can't answer that question succinctly and boom, 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 then, you know, so, but yeah, I'm pretty sure I did rip that from you in some other panel somewhere.
Awesome.
Or a conversation. But, you know, so I it's hard for me to really address your question without specifics, I think, too. I mean, I think that's the point I would leave with is, like, you mentioned a university is one thing, and, like, if someone wanted to do an impact evaluation of a university, I would say, no, you don't do that. That's not, it's a lofty question, but it's not answerable.
We have time for one more question. I will say, on the issue of measuring the effectiveness of advocacy organizations, SSIR has run a number of articles on that. It is possible to do that. It's a little bit different than measuring changes at institutions, but there's some maybe similarities. So one question, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Hi, Ruth Rominger from the Garfield Foundation. Thank you for all of the work you're doing. I think all of you had some really great insights about what should be happening in the foundation and advocate relationships. I think I want to raise the bar a little bit on the accountability for foundations and philanthropists. All of the issues we're trying to work on to solve are highly complex, and there are hundreds of thousands of advocates in the world doing work, many of which, you know, you've spoken about not measuring impact, not having management skills. But the very nature of how philanthropy is working is perpetuating a lot of that. And what I'm wondering is what you see from your vantage point globally. Are philanthropists actually getting together who are trying to solve these complex issues, and analyzing the issue together, looking at the kinds of things that you're doing, but across an issue area, and then somehow strategically coordinating or aligning their work to be more reinforcing.
It's actually ready-made for Kevin. I think maybe the Big Bang, you could talk about Big Bang.
Yeah, and I'm curious to see what you guys have encountered, but yeah, we realized we had a bunch of funders who we were doing a lot of stuff with often, and we liked them, we thought they were smart, and we were learning from them. And so we thought, well, let's give this just enough structure to make it easier to collaborate, and then who else can we pull in? And so we've ended up with about 15 funders who are all committed to meeting the basic needs of the very poor, who all believe in real impact and believe that things need to go to scale. And everybody funds in their own way. There's no pooled funds or anything. There's nobody riding herd on anybody else. But we share a lot of due diligence, we share leads, and we share ideas about better funding. And if we stick with that, it works really well. Nobody's trying to herd anybody else's cat herd.
Last comments?
I would say I've had similar, like the graduation thing, just as an example, definitely was, you had, you know, Ford Foundation funded most of the research, USAID funded some, MasterCard funded a lot of the advocacy and gatherings for the community of knowledge across groups. So there was definitely a collaboration of donors where each one had their kind of shtick and they funded their shtick, but it all fit together nicely.
Thank you all. Asif, Dean, and Kevin for, I think, a terrific panel.
You've been listening to a podcast by Stanford Social Innovation Review, a part of the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society at Stanford University. For more podcasts, articles, and other content about innovating for social change, please visit our website at ssir.org, follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook. I'm Eric Nie, and thank you for listening.